Lecture 19, The Tomb of Tutankhamun.
Now we come on to an immortal tale of archaeological discovery. The story, and it's an immortal story, of the discovery of the Egyptian pharaoh Tutankhamun's tomb in the Valley of Kings near Luxor in Egypt in 1922. This lecture begins with really the hero of the story, an archaeologist named Howard Carter. We describe his training and early career as an artist, which gave him an expertise in Egyptology and in the burial place of the New Kingdom pharaohs, the Valley of Kings. Then we describe how in 1907 he starts work with Lord Carnarvon, a wealthy English aristocrat. And in the second part of the lecture, we follow the long, unsuccessful search for the sepulchre and describe the dramatic discovery of the undisturbed tomb in November 1922. And finally, we take a survey of the contents of the tomb and talk about the significance of the boy pharaoh and what we know about him. This discovery of the undisturbed tomb of the Egyptian pharaoh Tutankhamun is the most celebrated of all archaeological stories and a very important moment in the history of archaeology. You see, by 1900, the tombs of all the New Kingdom pharaohs buried in the Valley of Kings opposite Thebes or Luxor in Upper Egypt were all known, every single one of them, except one, that of the pharaoh Tutankhamun. New Kingdom Egypt was a magnificent period of Egyptian civilization. It was the period when Egypt became a great imperial power, a major player in the thrust and cut of Eastern Mediterranean politics, competing with the Hittites, Mitanni, and other powers for control of strategic Eastern Mediterranean trade routes. Tutankhamun himself reigned from 1333 to 1323 BC. He came to the throne while still a boy and reigned for only a short time. There's a bit of background here. Just before he was born, a heretic pharaoh, Akhenaten, became the king of Egypt. Akhenaten is dismissed by Egyptologists, alternatively as a heretic, or a religious fanatic, or just as plain crazy. Nobody knows. Maybe he suffered from some chronic illness. Again, the literature is silent. But a number of things are known. The first one was that he was the equivalent of an evangelist. He appears to have believed in an extremely pure form of sun worship. Sun worship of the sun's disk, Aten. At the time, the worship of the sun god Amun, Amun-Re, commemorated with the great temples at Karnak and Luxor, was all-powerful in Egypt. The powerful priests of Karnak, on behalf of Amun, owned enormous tracts of land and exercised tremendous economic and probably political clout as well. Akhenaten dismissed Amun as irrelevant. He embraced the worship of Aten. As pharaoh, he was all-powerful. His word was literally law. He closed down Karnak and Luxor. He abolished the worship of the sun god Amun to obscurity. This was a very major political step, a very bold step, and one which apparently caused considerable unrest in his kingdom. He also moved his capital downstream to a place called El Amarna, where, for his reign, he lived in great splendor, in a royal precinct isolated from the rest of the town, and the town flourished for 17 years. It was then abandoned. His capital is priceless to archaeologists because nothing has been built on top of it, and there we really can plan and survey the layout of a royal capital in Egypt, a priceless piece of information for understanding how royal rule worked. He died. Almost immediately, the worship of the sun god Amun was restored as memories of the heretic pharaoh were erased. The regents who ran the kingdom on the behalf of Tutankhamun were major instruments in this restoration. They did it systematically in the king's name. How much Tutankhamun himself was involved in this, of course, is a matter for discussion. Probably not a great deal. For a lot of his reign, he was too young. But he died. He died suddenly, by all accounts, and passed into historical obscurity. He literally vanished. And certainly his tomb vanished, because by 1900 it was the only one of the royal tombs in the Valley of Kings which had not been located. That he was buried there seems certain, because all the Middle Kingdom and New Kingdom pharaohs, with the exception of Akhenaten, were interred there. And the search was on. People knew as long ago as Napoleonic times that this was a royal burial place. Our friend Giovanni Belzoni, the great tomb robber, whom we met much earlier in this course, found the tomb of Seti I, which had been lost for hundreds of years. But there remained, in the early 20th century, the tomb of Tutankhamun. And this tomb today is inextricably mixed up with the names of Howard Carter and Lord Carnarvon. Howard Carter was born in 1874. He died in 1939, just before the onset of World War II. He was born to very humble origins in eastern England. He was educated privately, the son of an artist, and inherited his father's gifts and became an extremely gifted artist indeed. Very early in his career, he was asked to work with a very prominent private collector in eastern England, an aristocrat, who allowed him to work with his enormous collection. This collection by Lord Amherst was truly exceptional and a wonderful way for the young Carter to learn the intricacies of Egyptology. And then he was sent in 1891 to copy tomb paintings in Egypt. This was a magnificent opportunity for a young man in a society where normally someone like him without university education wouldn't have a chance of becoming involved in Egyptology except in a very humble role. But he was a very gifted artist, came very strongly recommended by Lord Amherst, and showed such talent and superb artistry at his copying that he was encouraged to train as an Egyptologist. His copies today are much sought after art items because he didn't just slavishly copy, he tried to sort of communicate the essence of what the artist had been getting at. And his pictures of wildlife in particular are really lovely. They come from the walls of tombs, mainly in Middle Egypt. He was a promising young man, if moody, and was selected informally, everything was informal in those days, for training as an Egyptologist under, among others, Flinders Petrie, whom also we met earlier in this course. Flinders Petrie, famous for the austerity of his camps, for his training, which consisted basically of putting a young man or a young woman in charge of a trench, leaving him to it while keeping an eye on them. Carter worked, among other places, at El Amarna. He learnt planning, surveying, and excavation. he acquired at the same time, thanks to his copying as well as a constant handling of artifacts, a great deal about Egyptian art and daily life. He also got a very good feel indeed for what separated really fine antiquities from the day-to-day stuff that was so commonplace. In 1899, Howard Carter was appointed Inspector General of Monuments in Upper Egypt. This post, which was quite an important one, gave him an intimate knowledge of the Valley of Kings. This was his primary responsibility, making sure that tourists didn't do damage, checking on looters, checking on people excavating, supervising permits, and so on. But unfortunately, Howard Carter was a quarrelsome, difficult person. This probably stemmed from an insecurity resulting from his early and rather humble birth and education, because a lot of his life he spent working with extremely educated people. And in 1903, he became involved with an altercation with some French tourists at Saqqara in Lower Egypt, where he was working at the time. He was on the wrong side of this argument, because there were powerful people behind the tourists. And although he was correct in rebuking them and confronting them for inappropriate behavior, he submitted his resignation and, for the next 4 years, became a freelance artist. There was a constant stream of tourists going through Luxor, where he lived. He eked out a living, but he did make a living doing paintings of antiquities and dealing in artifacts on the side. He made quite a lot of money doing this. It was all above board and perfectly reputable, but he did it because in those days the selling of antiquities was an accepted pastime. And then in 1907, thanks to contacts in the Egyptian Department of Antiquities, where he had many friends, he was introduced to a wealthy English aristocrat, George Edward Stanhope Molyneux, the 5th Earl of Carnarvon, who had an interest in art and archaeology and wished to do some excavating during his annual stay in Egypt during the winters. Lord Carnarvon was born in 1866. He was the consummate English aristocrat, born to a life of leisure and privilege, blessed with enormous landholdings and a huge income. He was an art collector and a sportsman. Everyone who knew him said he was a very charming man with excellent, indeed superb, exquisite taste in art. He was also interested in motor cars. Long before the days of today's gearheads, he was one of the first people in England to own a motor car, and one of the first people in England to nearly be killed in a car smash in Germany. He collided with an ox cart. This nearly killed him. But he recovered and was advised by his doctors to spend his winters in Egypt, where the winters were dry. Any of you who've spent a winter in England will know that it's very damp and rather bad for the arthritis. And during his stays, he became interested in archaeology and did some judicious collecting, but collecting of antiquities of a very high standard. He collected old masters as well. This man had taste. And in 1907, he was introduced to Howard Carter, who was instructed to help him excavate. They became friends, an unlikely friendship, a man of humble origins and a great British aristocrat. And they worked well together, but they didn't find a great deal. They examined various tombs, all of which had been looted. But in the final analysis, Howard Carter really had persuaded Carnarvon that the place to excavate was the Valley of Kings. And he talked to him constantly about the tomb of Tutankhamun, that somewhere in that valley the tomb was waiting to be found. At the time, the concession for the Valley of Kings was held by Theodore Davis, a wealthy American. His excavations, which endured for years before World War I, yielded little except for the remains of the funeral feast of Tutankhamun, a few bags and the remains of a feast. So it was clear that somewhere in the valley the tomb lay. After years of finding nothing, the impatient Davis relinquished his concession, and it passed to Lord Carnarvon in 1914. World War I intervened. Carter was stuck in Egypt. Carnarvon turned his house in England into a convalescent home for wounded officers. But in 1919, Howard Carter began the search for Tutankhamun's tomb. He searched for it from 1919 to 1921, moving thousands of tons of stony rubble across the valley floor in a systematic search which started near the tomb of Ramesses VI for the tomb of Tutankhamun. He found absolutely nothing. In 1922, Carnarvon jibbed. He said, "I've spent enough. I don't want to spend more." But Carter persuaded him to finance one more season, the argument that swayed him being one that Carter himself, who had very little money, said he would pay for it himself. Reluctantly, Carter agreed. Carnarvon agreed. And Carter started work in November 1922. 3 days into the season, his workers uncovered a rock stairway, only a few feet from where he had started work in 1919. He excavated the stairway and at the bottom found a sealed doorway, and on the doorway were the seals of the necropolis guards, the ancient Egyptian guards. He sealed it up, sealed the hole, placed the guard on it, cabled Lord Carnarvon in England, and said, "Come at once, I have found an undisturbed tomb. Today you can fly from London to Cairo in 4 hours, surrounded by plastics and soft music." In those days it took 3 weeks by steamer and railroad to get to Egypt. And it took Carnarvon 3 weeks to get to the Valley of Kings. But on November the 24th, 1922, the two men stood in front of the sealed doorway. Carter dug a hole, saw a rubble passage. They took the door down, cleared the rubble, and in front of them was another sealed doorway. And on the doorway was the seal of the pharaoh Tutankhamun. Carter cleared a small hole at the top corner and peered through it with a candle. He was silent. "What do you see? What do you see?" said Carnarvon impatiently, standing behind him. And Carter stood back from the hole and said, "Wonderful things. Just wonderful things." He was speechless. They took down the door, and in front of them was a passageway, and on the passageway floor in the dust were the footprints of those who had cleared the tomb. They wandered in a daze through the antechamber of a tomb crammed with collapsed chariots, funerary beds, and unimaginable undisturbed treasures. They had found the tomb of Tutankhamun. The discovery caused an international sensation, which hampered Carter's efforts to clear the sepulchre. Crowds of tourists mobbed the entrance, demanding that they be shown the tomb. The Egyptian government staked claims for the artifacts, and to cap it all, Lord Carnarvon got bitten by a mosquito soon after the two men had quarrelled, owing to the pressure of the situation. Lord Carnarvon died in the days before penicillin from his mosquito bite, which went septic. He was never very healthy, soon after the opening of the tomb. And Carter carried on himself. Inevitably, there was the talk of the curse of the pharaohs striking Carnarvon down in revenge. But the media forgot that most of the people who worked on the tomb lived to the ripe old age of 80 plus. It took Howard Carter 8 years to clear Tutankhamun's tomb. He started with the antechamber, which was crammed with the personal possessions of the pharaoh. Funerary beds, boxes containing games, clothes, ornaments, and other treasures. Tutankhamun's chariots collapsed as if prefabricated, and guarding a sealed wall at the end, two black painted statues of the king inlaid in gold. And about a year after the discovery, Carnarvon arranged a formal opening of the tomb. He opened it and found, he mocked a hole in the wall, and there in front of him was a shrine, a golden shrine. The burial was undisturbed, and he allowed each member of the party to go in and look at the burial chamber. They had to crawl in. It was very difficult to get in there. And, as he said in a book he wrote soon afterwards, as each person came out, each had a dazed, bewildered look in his eyes, and each in turn, as he came out, threw up his hands before him, an unconscious gesture of impotence to describe the wonders he had seen. We had been present at the funeral ceremonies of a king, long dead and almost forgotten. Over the months that followed, Carter laboriously cleared the burial chamber. He dismantled the interlocking gold shrines, which protected the granite sarcophagus inside, leaning the dismantled walls of the shrines up against the walls of the chamber so he could take them out later. He then opened the sarcophagus, and inside it was the wooden inlaid inner coffin, and inside that was the golden coffin of the king, 296 pounds of gold. And inside that was the mummy itself wrapped in fabric, which again was the subject of a formal examination in public. Crude by today's standards, today we would know more about Tutankhamun medically than he knew himself because of modern technology. In those days they had x-rays and not much else. But they found the body of a young man with fine features. His body, unfortunately, the mummy, was not well preserved, owing to the enormous amounts of unguents that had been poured onto the body. And the cause of his death was a complete mystery. It is still debated. The contents of the chambers were exceptionally well preserved, but they presented an extraordinary challenge in clearance. Today, you drive up to the Valley of Kings on a tarmac road. In those days, there was no road. All that Carter could do was take the finds to a nearby empty tomb where he packed them very carefully and did an emergency conservation. He used, for example, over 2 miles of bandages. The contents were then loaded on railroad mining cars, placed on track, of which he only had a certain amount, and the track was laid, the cart pushed, then more track laid and pushed all the way down to the Nile in 100-degree heat. This was an amazing achievement, and these were very, very tough people indeed to have done it. Carter's achievement was truly extraordinary, and the finds dazzled the world. Off the burial chamber was a small treasury which contained a magnificent body, a statue of the dog god Anubis, little containers which contained the soft organs of the king, some magnificent models of boats. The artifacts were perfectly preserved, wood in beautiful condition, cloth, sandals, ceremonial thrones, an amazing range of personal and public effects. The point about all this is that he's the only one of the pharaohs who lives as a human being. We see his toys. We see his personal possessions. We see his canopic jars. He is a public and a private person, and yet he remains curiously anonymous. There were no papyri in the tomb, no inscriptions beyond the ritual inscriptions accompanying every pharaoh, and there was every sign that he was buried very hastily, as if he died rather suddenly. What did he die of? We have no idea. Some people argue that he was poisoned. Poisoned by his ambitious vizier, whose name was Ai, who had ambitions for the throne at a time of considerable political unrest. Other people point to a traumatic injury on his head and wonder if he was killed in a military expedition south to Nubia, where the Egyptians were constantly fighting. Or did he die of some disease which you are unable to detect, being chronically unhealthy? We simply don't know. Now, Howard Carter was never a member of Britain's scientific establishment. In his time, his humble birth and lack of wealth, despite his close friendship with Carnarvon, ensured that he would never become a member of the establishment. Nor was he ever honored for his discovery and for the laborious work of clearing the tomb. The only university that gave him an honorary degree was Yale in the United States. He died before he was able to complete anything but a popular account of the tomb. Indeed, research upon it and publication of it goes on to this day. The discovery of the tomb of Tutankhamun was a remarkable achievement, carried out as it was under very primitive working conditions and with minimal technology. Fortunately, Egyptologists from around the world cooperated in the recovery effort. In an unprecedented show of cooperation, he was buried hastily, and they were able to show that he was buried hastily by the people who buried him. They also showed that the artifacts he was buried with were a curious mix of new and recycled funerary furniture, some from other pharaohs' tombs. Maybe he was murdered. We don't know. But the importance of Tutankhamun today is vital. Why? Because his tomb survived detection by earlier looters, because the necropolis guards went to great pains to conceal the entrance. They filled the entryway with rubble after abortive robberies soon after the funeral. So today, this obscure and unimportant pharaoh is the best known of all Egyptian monarchs. The incredible riches of his sepulchre make us realize just how much has been looted and lost from the tombs of such important rulers as Seti and Ramesses II of the New Kingdom. With the opening of Tutankhamun's tomb, the search for ancient Egypt and for ancient civilizations came of age. With Tutankhamun's tomb, spectacular finds of palaces and cities gave way inexorably to more deliberate researches aimed more at understanding the dynamics of early civilization rather than to make exciting finds. At the same time in Egypt, there was a hardening of attitude to foreign scholars, to the removal of priceless treasures from Egypt. At intervals, the Egyptian government shut down Carter's excavations until the dispute over the ownership of the finds was resolved. In the end, Howard Carter's estate was paid over £100,000 to pay for his costs of the excavations. And the finds today remain in Cairo, travelling occasionally to foreign lands for exhibitions which attract thousands of visitors. You see, this king has a magical effect on people because he shows us the extraordinary wealth of ancient Egyptians and their monarchs. In this lecture, we've looked at one of the most spectacular archaeological discoveries of all, if not the most spectacular, the undisturbed tomb of Tutankhamun. And we've shown how a humble pharaoh, little known in his day or after it, was able to galvanize people's interest in ancient Egypt by displaying the sheer wealth of this civilization. In the next lecture, Lecture 20, we move to Mesopotamia, where the British archaeologist Leonard Woolley, whom we've already discussed in the context of Hittite Carchemish, carried out his classic excavations at Ur from 1922 to 1934. Excavations overshadowed by the finding of Tutankhamun's tomb.